Manuel Pineda, one of her European Parliament colleagues. The mission was partly in response to the killing of Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Aghle. Pineda is the president of Parliament's delegation for EU-Palestine relations and thus plays an essential role in monitoring the use of European Union funding and the actions of the bloc's officials on the ground. Metsola did not show solidarity with her colleagues or demand that the Zionist regime respect the European Parliament by cancelling her visit. Instead, she issued a tweet expressing regret at Pineda's exclusion and claiming she would raise the issue directly with authorities concerned. The fabricated regime of Israel will almost certainly perceive these soft words, followed by Metsola's lavish and unconditional praise for the apartheid regime, as acquiescence and even a green light to continue excluding anyone it considers insufficiently subservient. It is unlikely coincidental that Pineda is currently the target of a character assassination campaign by the Israeli regime lobby. Recently, the Simon Wiesenthal Center published an open letter to Ursula von der Leyen, the unelected president of the European Commission, demanding that the popularly elected Pineda must be expelled from the European Parliament on the basis that he is a spokesman for terrorists. The Israeli regime lobby group laundry list of grievances against Pineda includes that he joined a 2011 flotilla to Gaza aiming to break Israeli regime's brutal blockade on the territory, and that he associates with members of Palestinian and Lebanese political groupings and resistance groups that the Zionist regime and its European allies have arbitrarily designated as terrorists. The anti-Palestinian group even repeats unsubstantiated smears that Pineda's left-wing party, Podemos, a member of Spain's governing coalition, was allegedly financed by some countries. These claims emerged in 2016, a part of what one Podemos voter termed a dirty campaign by Spain's then right-wing government. Yet they are exactly the kind of smears and the Zionist regimes and its lobby regularly use against anyone who dares to criticize them or stand with Palestinians. Leading Palestinian human rights organizations sent an open letter to European Parliament President Roberta Metsola. They denounced her decision to visit the occupied territories even after authorities there barred the delegation led by Pineda, with whom they were due to meet. They also condemned her offer of stronger ties with the Zionist regime, while failing even to mention the killing of Abu Aghle, as well as the Zionist regime's accelerating expulsions of Palestinian villagers in Masafer Yatta area of the West Bank. The groups told Metsola that you have failed to fulfill your responsibility under international law and make yourself complicit in the institutionalized domination and systematic oppression of the Palestinian people. Some of the groups that wrote to Metsola are among the six baselessly designated by the fabricated regime of Israel as terrorist organizations last year in an effort to stymie and discredit their work documenting its crimes. The EU, which has funded several of those groups, has allowed the fake regime of Israel to get away with the smearing. Now the EU is allowing the Zionist regime to do the same to its elected representatives. Brussels will do whatever it takes to serve and appease the fake regime of Israel and its lobby, even if that means deliberately and knowingly inflicting additional suffering on Palestinian cancer patients.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the sharp spike in violence, harassment and persecution of minority Muslims in Hindu-majority India and an uncertain future for the country. We shall also take a look at the Indian government's decision to ban the export of wheat amid the food crisis gripping the world, angering the wealthiest countries.
The incidents of violence, harassment and persecution of Muslims are snowballing across India as the Narendra Modi government completes its 8 years in power. In recent months, there have been communal clashes and arrests of Muslims in different parts of the country, from Madhya Pradesh to West Bengal to New Delhi. Instead of dousing the flames of violence and hatred, the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has been accused of fanning those flames and pushing the world's largest democracy towards a dark and uncertain future.
Hindu religious processions moving through predominantly Muslim neighborhoods, saffron flags being hoisted on mosques, swords being brandished during Hindu festivals, bulldozers rolling into Muslim neighborhoods to raze buildings to the ground. Violence against the minority Muslim community in India is usually portrayed as spontaneous, but these incidents are more often meticulously planned. On April the 20th, a convoy of bulldozers rolled into a North Delhi neighborhood, razing several buildings to the ground, including the entrance gate of a mosque as well as homes and shops belonging to Muslims. Local authorities claimed the structures were being razed for being illegal, but they prevented a bulldozer from bringing down the entrance of a Hindu temple barely 50 meters from the mosque. It was evident that the campaign was aimed at a particular community to destroy their homes, livelihoods, and places of worship as part of a diabolic plan to wipe out their identity. The incident came days after communal violence broke out in the same area when Hindutva gangs attempted to hoist the saffron flag on a local mosque. These incidents are not confined to the Indian capital, though. Similar incidents have been reported from Madhya Pradesh, Jharkhand, Bihar, West Bengal, etc. The brazenness of radical Hindu groups is disturbing, and the government's inaction is scandalous.
Communal riots have taken place throughout India's history. In the past, governments used to discourage such eruptions through condemnations and compensations. That's no longer the case. Since the BJP government rose to power in 2014, anti-Muslim activities have virtually got an official sanction. The party today rules both at the centre in India and in about half of India's states. The top BJP leaders tend to believe that to remain in power, it needs to mount majoritarianism and political polarization in order to lay the foundation of a Hindu nation.
This month, Narendra Modi completes 8 years as India's Prime Minister. During his term in office, there has been a careful attempt to convince the majority Hindu community that the country's biggest problem is its Muslims. The panacea for all problems lies in turning India into a Hindu Rashtra, a term coined by the ideological godfather of Hindu fanatics, Vinayak Savarkar. Modi and his acolytes have taken it upon themselves to turn Savarkar's dream into a reality. Before the Hindu Nationalist Party assumed power in 2014, many people thought their main concerns were poverty, economic recession and corruption. Modi promised to address the problems, but while the economy has deteriorated under him, his party has increasingly fallen back on hate-filled, supremacist politics to deflect attention and avoid responsibility. According to an independent hate crime tracker, in the last 4 years alone, over 400 hate crimes were carried out against Muslims in India. The organizations at the forefront of anti-Muslim violence include Vishwa Hindu Parishad and Bajrang Dal, both of them linked to the ruling party. In the name of celebrating Hindu festivals, they have carried out organized violence against Muslims in different Indian states, and their leaders have made open calls for abduction, rape, and genocide of Muslims. And the juggernaut rolls on.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Ahmed Hussain, spokesperson for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee from London, UK. Now, welcome to the programme, sir. Now, since the Hindu nationalist BJP came to power in 2014, Indian Muslims have had to change the way they dress, eat, and even speak in public. Now, how difficult is it to be a Muslim in India today?
It's not only difficult to be a Muslim in India today, it's also getting harder and harder to fight for equal treatment for Muslims as well. So in MPAC UK, we regularly host events where we invite speakers to talk about the situation in India, and activists tell us how it's just getting harder for them to stand up for Muslims' rights. They get singled out for punishment because they're known for criticising the current and historic Hindu supremacy in India. There was one event where one of our speakers, Sharjil Usmani, he couldn't even attend to speak because he was on the run from the police because of how he had worded one speech. That's the level of the absurdity of the scrutiny that Muslims face in India.
Mr. Hussain, BJP has moved to turn Mahatma Gandhi's secular India into a Hindu nation by othering the country's largest minority group. Now, do you think the appeasement of Hindus and the alienation of Muslims works as a political strategy?
Look at the 2002 Gujarat pogroms, when Muslims were vilified so thoroughly that the BJP governor only had to say a few words and the whole region erupted in arson and looting and rape. That governor was Modi, who continued his policy of appeasing one side and alienating the other, and he became prime minister. And India has erupted again and again in 2020 with the Delhi riots and the farmers' protests, because the issues of poverty and societal breakdown don't get resolved by scapegoating Muslims and Sikhs and other minorities. Any politician whose strategy it is to divide and conquer is a danger to their own country.
Mr. Hussain, Muslim bashing has become Modi government's unstated policy, which can be seen from statements of ministers and MPs. Now, do you think the absence of strong political opposition has emboldened the BJP government to tear apart the country's rich secular democratic ethos?
As with any bully, they are empowered every time they get away with their attacks. And I say this because I want your viewers to appreciate that you cannot understand modern India without understanding what India has been doing to Kashmir. Kashmir has been a guinea pig, a punching bag, a political football, no matter which party was running India. That's meant that no major party in India has the moral ground to stand up against BJP's ethno-nationalism, because they've all aided and abetted the same ideology in Kashmir. If we want to see a restrained BJP across India, then we have to see justice for Kashmir too.
Mr. Hussain, as we know, there is no legal ban on wearing religious dress in public places in India, but Muslim women wearing hijab still face backlash and discrimination. So why does this piece of cloth give so much jitters to the ruling elites in India?
That's because India's ruling BJP have no solutions for the people. They only have myths and symbols to try and placate their voter base. So they see something that looks like a symbol of Islam, the headscarf, and they zero in on it as a distraction for their voter base. But look, if the BJP were actually serious about women's rights, they would do something about the police force and their problem of kidnapping and then raping and then blackmailing women, which is something that many human rights organizations have written many times about.
Last but not least, Mr. Hussain, what does the future hold for Muslims in India, especially the younger generation? And do you see a silver lining in dark clouds?
I've mentioned the events that MPAC UK have done highlighting the oppression of Indian Muslims. So I've seen for myself that the young generation of activists, they have the brains to understand the root causes of their oppression. They have the spine to stand up for their freedoms. And honestly, their example is something that Muslims over here in the UK and Europe can learn from, alhamdulillah. But what they need more of, what every Muslim needs, is solidarity with the oppressed, with all oppressed people, because their pain is our pain, and their freedom one day will be our freedom too.
Mr. Hussain, thank you for being on the program once again.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's see how people have reacted on social media on the violence, harassment and persecution of Muslims.
Khalid Beydoun, a law professor and author, says more Arabs and non-South Asian Muslims need to speak up on Hindutva terror in India, as Indian Muslims have always spoken up on Yemen, Palestine and Islamophobia in France. Senior Indian journalist Arfa Khanum Sharwani points to the difficulty of being a Muslim in today's India, urging the world to pay attention to the lives they are living under the Hindu nationalist BJP government. Ashok Swain, a Sweden-based Indian academic, refers to the closure of a mosque in Varanasi city to stress that Indian Muslims are struggling to survive under a majoritarian regime and highly partisan police force and judiciary.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In an interesting volte-face, India has banned the export of its wheat, partly due to the raging war in Ukraine and also the scorching heat wave curtailing output and pushing domestic prices to record highs. The populist move has been linked to the country's food security, as India, despite being the world's second largest producer of wheat, faces massive domestic food demand. This comes after India was initially eyeing as much as 12 million tons of wheat exports in 2022-23, significantly higher than last year's record exports of 7.2 million tons.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, during his talks with US President Joe Biden on April the 13th, said India was capable of feeding the world and filling the gap created by the Ukraine war. A month later, his government banned the export of wheat, shocking the world, including his own farmers. India, the second largest producer of wheat in the world, exported 8.2 million tons of wheat in the year leading to March 2022. The Modi government claimed that India could export anywhere between 10 and 15 million tons in the current fiscal year that ends March 2023. So far, less than 5 million tons have been contracted for exports, significantly less than the target. The move to ban exports is widely seen as part of a wave of protectionism sweeping the world in the backdrop of the Ukraine war. The knee-jerk decision came after the Indian government failed to buy enough wheat for its massive food security program, about 18 million tons compared with nearly 44 million tons last year. That was largely due to high exports and relatively lower harvest, as the scorching heat wave affected the yield. Rising food inflation also prompted New Delhi to reverse its decision.
India's ban on wheat exports has dealt a fresh blow to world markets at a time when the global buyers were banking on supplies from the world's second largest wheat producer. Low supplies from Canada, Europe and Australia and snarled supply lines in the war-torn Black Sea area have led to a rise in food prices, mostly hitting poor consumers in Asia and Africa. With the world's wealthiest countries denouncing New Delhi's knee-jerk decision, officials in India have pointed to the hypocrisy of the West, urging them to stop wasting food.
Although India is not one of the world's top wheat exporters, the ban is likely to push global food prices to new peaks, according to observers. Among those who have slammed the decision are the world's wealthiest countries. The move was denounced by agriculture ministers from the G7 industrialized nations, with German agriculture minister Cem Özdemir saying it would worsen the crisis. In response, Indian officials advised wealthy nations to stop wasting food and said New Delhi makes up less than 1% of global wheat exports. As per the UN Environment Programme, the US ranks 59 in terms of household food waste estimate per kilogram on capita every year, while Japan, Italy and Germany are at 64, 67 and 75 respectively, an Indian official was cited as saying. Some even pointed to the hypocrisy of G7 countries, recalling how the US, under the America First policy, banned the export of not just vaccines, but also raw materials required for their production in 2021. Among top destinations for Indian exports are Bangladesh, Indonesia, Nepal, and Turkey. And top global buyer Egypt also agreed recently to make a first-ever purchase of Indian wheat. Russia, Europe, US and Canada are the top global wheat exporters, accounting for roughly 60% of world wheat exports.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Mushtaq Lashari, the founder and chairman of Third World Solidarity, based in London, UK. Welcome to the programme, sir. Now, Mr. Lashari, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi last month offered to help mitigate the global wheat deficit and, quote, feed the world. What has prompted New Delhi now to ban the export of this commodity?
I think, and we all know, what is the Narendra Modi's attitude toward the people of the world, whether it is human rights or whether it is related to food or anything. His main objective is to promote his populist Hindutva sort of policies. And he's doing it again. He wants to take, negotiate some sort of facilitation from the Western world, which will be affected. Because as you know, in third world countries or in developing world, these issues are not so relevant to the democracies. But wherever there is a democracy, if the prices go high, as it is going already high in United Kingdom, it is 9% inflation this year, while they can't increase the salaries of the people to 9%. So they are already facing a lot of unpopularity, and same is happening in USA. So what they will try to do is, while, as you say, there is a crisis going on because of the war in between Russia and Ukraine, or Ukraine fighting back Russia, there is already shortage of many commodities, including wheat, soya oil, and many. So the prices will jump. And because of the gas issues, there is a price hike in everywhere in the Europe, in Western world, in UK, because of that. And I think India and a few other countries who have some influence or some thing they can do with these prices by allowing the people to export, they will try to get their maximum benefits from these countries. But he wants to remain popular in the country, and that's why he's trying to do it. And I know that the peasants and farmers are not happy with it, because they want to get benefit of it. And if he carries on with this ban, they can't export. And if they can't export it, their prices in the country where they have a surplus wheat and other things, that will drop.
Mr. Lashari, as we know, India is the world's second largest producer of wheat after China. Now, does this decision hurt the credibility of the Modi government and convey a message that it does not have a credible export policy?
Definitely it will. Although the Western world has no choice, America, Britain and other countries, because at the moment their target is China. But I think still it will harm the standing and status of India in the world, which will definitely, in my opinion, affect Modi's credibility in the world. And if he loses the credibility, it is not easy to establish again your credibility. So it will definitely affect the Indian credibility and status in the world.
Mr. Lashari, India's move, along with dwindling supplies from Russia and Ukraine, have sent wheat prices soaring in the international market. What could be its possible repercussions?
I think that because Ukraine and Russia are already being excluded from the world by sanctions and other things which are sanctioned, basically. Ukraine is getting a lot of support, financial and military, but Russia is being excluded and isolated in the world at the moment by putting a lot of sanctions. Although it is very difficult to implement those sanctions, but India can be a next target if India continues it, and that will be very difficult to sustain for Indian economy.
Sir, do you think the scathing criticism from G7 industrialized nations over the decision to ban the export of wheat could prompt India to revise its decision?
I personally believe that Modi is very weak. He would not sustain if G7 continues the pressure on them to allow to export the wheat. I don't think Indian economy, politically, socially, and economically can sustain the pressure from the Western world or from G7.
Last but not least, sir, how does this populist move affect farmers and traders in India who are apparently not happy?
Oh, basically, they are the people who elected Modi. He has been twice elected with a majority or popular vote. And if it economically affect the people of India, his popularity will go down. And he's already being criticized by the world or G7 and others by not looking after the minorities. This will be another issue which will affect him. But in my opinion, Modi might resist it because he knows that he's old. This is his last term, in my opinion. You never know, because in our part of the world, there is no restriction of continuing for third and fourth and fifth term. But I think he will definitely look at it, and it is possible that he will take a U-turn.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Lashari for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's go to social media to see what people think of India's ban on wheat exports amid global food crisis.
Former Indian diplomat M.K. Bhadrakumar slams Western pundits for criticizing India's decision to ban the export of wheat, arguing that all countries give primacy to the welfare of their own citizens. Minhas Merchant, a senior journalist and author, calls India's reaction to the criticism of G7 countries as tight slap, saying the industrialized nations ignore the fact that the move aims to ensure India's food security. Former Indian military officer Brigadier Mahalingam, responding to the statement by German agriculture minister over India's ban on wheat exports, urges him to ask the US to lift sanctions to allow free flow of commodities.
And that was our episode about the BJP government's anti-Muslim policies in India and New Delhi's move to ban the export of wheat. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The UK is not a significant haven for refugees. The country holds 1% of the world's total population and accepts fewer than 0.1% of the world's refugees each year. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Renton, writer. This article is published under the heading Boris Johnson dodged a COVID reckoning. Now he's doubling down on deportations. Here's the story. After weeks in which commentators had been predicting UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's removal from office for breaking the UK's own COVID-era public health laws, the impression now is that he has survived for the time being. The news that Johnson will not face any further fines after his staff were issued with 126 fixed penalty notices for COVID-19 breaches has been widely interpreted as proof of the Prime Minister's talent for survival. As one commentator put it, the Prime Minister has dodged a Partygate reckoning. As recently as this January, it had seemed that the Conservative government might be doomed. The sense now is that Johnson has escaped, albeit with weakened authority. In the UK's political system, prime ministers are not directly elected, but hold office only indirectly through the support of a majority of their own members of parliament. Several of recent prime ministers, including Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair and Theresa May, were removed from office not because they had lost an election, but because elections were looming and their own MPs expected them to lose. Prime Minister Johnson's support remains, from this perspective, very thin. The Conservatives have not led in any poll since December last year, with 148 national polls since then predicting losses for their party at the next general election. Something then, it follows, will have to change. Either the opposition Labour Party's lead will shrink and Johnson will be able to convert his weak administration into a durable regime, or Labour's lead will grow to the point where the prospect of the Conservatives' defeat at the next election seems so likely that his own MPs topple him. If the opposition's present poll advantage persists, we could see Johnson's regime end in a palace coup. The UK Prime Minister appears to believe that his government can boost its popularity with a new plan announced last month to deport refugees arriving in Britain for processing overseas. The plan is that refugees will be deported to Central Africa, forced to claim asylum there, and if successful, forcibly relocated not to Britain but to Rwanda. Johnson seems to believe that this flagship policy will bolster his support with wavering voters. The UK is not a significant haven for refugees. The country holds 1% of the world's total population and accepts fewer than 0.1% of the world's refugees each year. By effectively abandoning the UN Refugee Convention, the UK proposes to send a signal to the rest of the world that refugees can be ignored. The convention was signed in 1951. It was one of the series of international treaties signed with a common intention of protecting the world from a return to fascism. Its abandonment by the UK would be a small but ominously significant step in the global drift to authoritarianism. At the press conference where he announced the Rwanda plan, Boris Johnson suggested that it would face legal challenge from his opponents. "I know that this system will not take effect overnight," he said, adding, "We have such a formidable army of potentially motivated lawyers who for years have made it their business to thwart removals and frustrate the government. Component governments do not spend their time begging hostile lawyers to take them to court, nor do they predict, as Johnson seemed to do, that these lawyers will win. So why was the Prime Minister seemingly pleading with his opponents to sue him? And what are his opponents thinking by saying that they will indeed take this scheme to the court? To understand both sides' thinking, it is useful to look at the 2019 general election and the events which immediately preceded it. On August 28 that year, the government had announced that it was proroguing Parliament, seemingly in order to force through a settlement of the country's long-standing Brexit crisis without a vote. 4 weeks later, Supreme Court ruled that that measure has been unlawful. This was the greatest constitutional crisis Britain had seen in 300 years, with ministers insisting that according to the country's unwritten constitution, they could govern so long as they had the Queen's approval. Unlike the US, the UK does not have a single constitutional document. They do have laws of very great or constitutional significance. However, they are dispersed over several different documents, and there is no single agreed document setting out which of laws have this unique importance. By rejecting the doctrine that ministers could govern with the support of the Crown against the wishes of Parliament, the Supreme Court became the saviour of the separation of powers in the UK political system and doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty. But even though the 11 Supreme Court justices ruling unanimously against prorogation, the British public has had other ideas. Just 3 months after the Supreme Court's ruling, the Conservatives increased their seats by 48 votes, converting what had been a narrow minority government into a secure majority one. To make matters worse, a significant portion of the seats newly won by the Conservatives were Rust Belt towns, which had been taken for granted as Labour seats, representing places such as Redcar, never previously won by the Conservatives, or Leigh in Manchester, last lost by Labour in 1922. The most common explanation for Johnson's victory was that working-class voters had been attracted to a populist candidate promising to break all the rules. It is this story which Johnson likes to tell, and in that context, we can see why he is so willing to risk international criticism and play the role of a mid-Atlantic Donald Trump. Why should Johnson care if democracy suffers so long as he continues to govern? Johnson seems to see the prospect of a defeat in the courts over the Rwanda scheme as his opportunity to rerun the battles that brought about his victory in 2019. However, for his liberal critics, the context is more favorable now than 3 years ago. Johnson has been prime minister all this time. It is harder for him to pose as an outsider. Inflation in the UK is at 9%, the highest it has been in 40 years. Rising food and electricity prices are taking money out of the pockets of key groups of Conservative voters, including those who live on savings and the elderly. Depressingly, the opposition Labour Party too often presents the issue as one of competence. As if what is wrong with the proposal of deporting refugees to Rwanda is that the government has gone about this scheme in a shambolic fashion, failing to obtain any guarantees from Rwanda and at excessive cost. This reflects Labour's self-presentation as a party with no different politics than the Conservatives, only a much greater belief in the rules. Yet the Conservatives are turning on refugees at the very moment that more British people are opening their homes to refugees than ever before. Since the start of the crisis in Eastern Europe, more than 50,000 people have sought temporary refuge in the UK. An official website through which British people could register to offer their homes to new arrivals crashed after people volunteered their assistance at the rate of 10,000 offers an hour. This instinct of generosity, the belief of ordinary voters that refugees should be welcomed, is the force which could yet topple Johnson.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The US has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the US state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack.
I was just devastated. It's heart-rending for us as grandparents. We have children in the age vicinity that happened here. It's overwhelming.
In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and six staff were killed.
Why are you here? If not to solve a problem as existential as this. This isn't inevitable. These kids weren't unlucky. This only happens in this country and nowhere else. Nowhere else do little kids go to school thinking that they might be shot that day.
The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York.
So to me, it's really two factors. It's troubled kids, troubled young people, and guns. And every country has troubled young people to some extent, but not every country has a system where you can get guns so easily.
The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people.
The Republican Republican Party, Democratic Party can't say anything about it because the colonial mode of production, the violence that's required by the colonial mode of production is what keeps, is the lifeblood for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society.
So, no, there is no irony that the biggest purveyor of colonial violence is also the biggest supplier of guns. That's why they have hundreds of military installations. They, being the United States, has, hundreds of military installations around the world, Army, Air Force, Marines, and the Coast Guard, whatever else they have, and even in within the United States borders, the police department, sheriff department, the marshals, all those instruments of violence exist.
The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations. U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack. In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed. The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York. The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people. That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society. The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ebrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament to, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ebrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.